In a book called The Second World, this was before the extent of the financial crisis could be seen, and of course it's still unknown, Parag Khanna, today's guest, foresaw a planet dominated not by the U.S., but by three superpowers, the U.S., China, and Europe. However, he believes if the U.S. tightens trade and energy ties to the rest of the hemisphere, pursues economic innovation at home, and establishes what he calls a diplomatic industrial complex, Khanna believes the U.S. can grow stronger at the same time as the globe becomes less red, white, and blue. I hope to talk to Parag Khanna about his book and the changing balance of power, about Mumbai and India-Pakistan relations, the recent NIC 2025 Global Trends Report, which suggests the U.S. days of dominance are numbered, the global financial crisis, and finally, Obama's foreign policy, trade, and national security priorities. Parag Khanna has been an informal advisor to the Obama campaign for many months. Parag Khanna was born in India, raised in the United Arab Emirates, the United States, and Germany. He specialized in scenario and risk planning at the World Economic Forum. He conducted research on terrorism and conflict resolution at the Council on Foreign Relations. And in 2007, he served as a senior geopolitical advisor to the United States Special Operations Forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. As a senior research fellow and the director of the Global Governance Initiative at the New America Foundation, Khanna leads an effort to find innovative strategies for governmental, corporate, and civil society collaboration to resolve pressing global problems and redefine diplomacy for the 21st century. Parag Khanna's writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Financial Times, Harper's, Slate. His first book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order, has been highly praised, and his upcoming book, How to Run the World, will be on the future of diplomacy. Welcome, Parag Khanna.
Terry, thank you so much. Great to speak with you.
Good to hear your voice again. Let me start. What I like to do is give people a sense, give listeners a sense of the people behind some of the ideas and the work. And as I clicked through your resume, the early part of growing up in all those different countries, we don't have time to deal with. But I want to touch on several of the things that you've done over the last few years, just to get a sense of what that path has been to where you are today. You conducted research on terrorism and conflict resolution at the Council on Foreign Relations. What were you doing there?
Well, I was that was my first job out of college, actually, to be a research associate at the Council, which is, you know, one of the old steam think tanks on the East Coast. And I worked with a number of different fellows, and of course, who would have known what regions would be hot and what would be timely. But of all things, I worked with a professor named Jessica Stern, who's a lecturer at the Kennedy School at Harvard, on Lashkar-e-Taiba and on Pakistan and Kashmir. So that proved to be something that was would be of value about 10 years ago. I also work with Barnett Rubin, who's a fellow at the Center on International Cooperation at NYU and someone who is widely regarded as the world's leading expert on Afghanistan, at least in the West. And so, you know, those are two of the scholars that I worked with in looking at Central Asia, conflict resolution, terrorism, and so forth. And it introduced me to the post-Soviet Central Asian world and to Afghanistan and research on those countries in a way that was not particularly advanced in the U.S. And still really isn't. I mean, those are very complicated. That's a very complicated region of the world where many of the governments are still holdovers from the Soviet era, and the U.S. has not had a very sophisticated policy towards them in the last 20 years.
Okay, and then you specialized in scenario and risk planning at the World Economic Forum. I've read a quote from you a couple of places where you said you'd something like attended seven World Economic Forums by the time you were 30, which you didn't know was necessarily a good thing.
Well, I mean, Davos is one aspect of what the World Economic Forum does, but the institution itself, which is based in Geneva, is a very interesting hybrid organization, which I hold to be an example of where diplomacy is going. And as you mentioned at the beginning, that's what my next book is about. It's a place that's privately funded by corporations, but really serves as a platform for NGOs, companies, and governments to get together. And some call it just a talk shop. And yes, there's lots of debate, just in discussion, just as there is at any other diplomatic organization or convention. But what they really do is hatch a lot of innovative partnerships that relate to water, to climate reduction to public health partnerships. Really, you name the issue, and they, in fact, even disaster relief, pre-positioning of construction supplies to deal with natural disasters and so forth. So there's a lot of concrete, innovative partnerships that are forged through World Economic Forum meetings that are, you know, largely done behind the scenes, but also done quite openly, and it's actually a very transparent organization, which is not what many people think of when they think about the Davos meeting. So it's a very unique place to work, and it was really opened my eyes to the future of diplomacy, which is, you know, really an issue that stuck with me and why I'm doing my next book on it.
And when you say partnerships or collaborations, am I correct in assuming you mean between states, NGOs, corporations, all of them?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Very little of what is good in terms of what in terms of tangible progress that's achieved on the ground today. Let's say you're trying to deal with, the Kimberley process with diamonds, or you're trying to, clean up corruption in oil-rich countries in Africa, or anything related to development and public health and all of these public goods kinds. There is very little of what is done today that actually works and that's successful does not involve in some kind of alliance among corporations, NGOs, and governments. This is already the reality, I would say, of diplomacy, not just its future.
Okay. And so then in 2007, you serve as a senior geopolitical advisor to U.S. Special Ops Forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. What was that about?
That's not something I'm actually supposed to talk about.
Oh.
But it was a very, you know, useful experience in trying to take countries that I had been traveling and researching in on my own and trying to advise to whatever extent it was useful. Military forces operating in the Middle East and beyond to just kind of give a different perspective on where I see the strategic landscape going. But I can, you know, only say that at any given point in time in whether you call it the war on terror or some other term, the advice that one gives can only be useful for a particular time because things are changing very fast.
Your big title these days is Senior Research Fellow, Director of the Global Governance Initiative, the New America Foundation. What are you doing there, and how successful and satisfying is that kind of work?
Well, being in a think tank is very interesting. It's mostly what I've been doing for the last 10 years is jumping from various, from one think tank to the other. These are places that tend to be very small compared to corporations or even larger NGOs, you know, maybe 100, 200 people, research staff of 50 to 75 people. And you basically, in a nutshell, get to do whatever you want. You know, you get foundation funding and you're able to do research on the issues you want, consult various government agencies on your research, go out and travel. That's my MO, at least for this last book, was much more to travel than anything else in terms of collecting my material and insights from various places. So I didn't even spend much time in an office at all. And I don't tend to. I try to go out and around the world and see what's happening and see what works with respect to the problems that I think need to be solved. So in terms of global governance, that's precisely what I'm doing. I mentioned the examples of poverty and public health in Africa before. I'm looking at a wide variety of other questions. Just take post-conflict reconstruction in Afghanistan, where the UN and US and NATO-led effort clearly hasn't been succeeding very well. What is necessary there, among other things, is a much greater role for social enterprise, private investment, job creation, all the kinds of things that are important for counterinsurgency, but are also important for economic development. And we've seen a lot less focus on that in the last 7 years than we should have. And those things, again, as I mentioned with other examples related to Africa, you need a much greater role for NGOs and companies in solving those problems. But you don't see the structures in Afghanistan, the kind of governance mechanisms that are public and private at the same time, as you would need. And so this is why, my initiative is focusing on what are the public-private partnership, modes of diplomacy that are going to get us to those solutions.
When you see a title like Global Governance Initiative, I'm sure there are some people that say, well, that sounds like black helicopters and so on. What do you and New America mean by that?
Well, it's not a term that either I or New America sort of invented. It's sort of the academic term to capture what we mean when we talk about not just international organizations like the United Nations and then the corresponding fear that some in, you know, wherever, whatever part of the U.S. have about black helicopters. But it's multi-level, it's multi-dimensional. It involves rulemaking, and corporations are involved in global rulemaking. It involves implementation, which NGOs are involved in. So it's a different set of actors. It's transnational. It's not just intergovernmental. So global governance means a lot of different processes that are simultaneously happening that address.
Right. It's not necessarily a world federalist order.
No, yeah. And there's a good column today in the Financial Times by someone I know, Gideon Rockman, who's a columnist for the FT. And, you know, he addresses this question as well. He says there is not a world government, you know, happening, but there are certainly signs of global governance emerging.
You are a host of Interview on MTV. What is that?
That's a new show that no one will have seen yet. We've started taping, and it will begin airing on various MTV stations and on a new portal online that they're launching. They have far more, you know, visitors, I think, to MTV's websites than even to television these days. It's a sign of the times and technology. But it's a program called Interview instead of Interview,
right,
which I, you know, go sort of, you know, behind the scenes with a number of leading personalities. So far, we've taped episodes with Naomi Klein, Thomas Friedman, Shashi Tharoor, and a variety of other celebrities and personalities.
Yeah, I went up on the site and saw two of the things you're mentioning. One is that it does seem to be very much about the social community, the discussions and so on the site. It's made very easy to watch clips on the site. But also that, I must say, Naomi Klein is not the first person people think of when you say MTV.
Right. And, well, I mean, you know, and I'm not the first person people think of when they think MTV.
Exactly.
The point here is to actually, you know, really have a very smart and in-depth, substantive conversation with people who are influential, insightful, intelligent. You know, my next taping is going to be with Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University, who's a senior advisor to the United Nations. So, you know, these are the kinds of people that we're having on the program. And the discussion is great. You know, for me, it's as if I were in my think tank, but instead it's an MTV studio.
Well, I look forward to that. Okay, let's turn to the book, The Second World. And what do you mean by The Second World? That's the name of the book.
Well, it's important to point out what it used to mean. The Second World used to mean the Soviet socialist or communist allied countries in Eastern Europe and Asia. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that term ceased to be used. But, you know, we still say First World when we mean rich countries. We still say Third World to refer to poor countries. And to me, Second World countries are not halfway in between. They're not some global middle class, which we know very problematically does not exist. What I mean by Second World are countries that are halfway that are both at the same time. You have you know, some rich, you know, or connected globalized portion of the population, and you have masses of poor and disconnected people. And it's that state of being kind of first world and third world simultaneously that I call Second World. But these are also very strategic countries that are kind of reshaping the diplomatic balance of power. So I chose about 40 countries and that I traveled through in 2005 and 2006, and I focused on how they are emerging in the global economy, in the global, you know, strategic and diplomatic kind of frameworks, and how they're shifting the balance of power away from U.S. hegemony and dominance towards a world that is truly multipolar. And, you know, that's clearly where things are going, and, you know, this financial crisis has only accelerated our realization of that.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that you basically say is that the Americans' dominant moment has been replaced by a geopolitical marketplace.
That's right.
And now, did you have that premise before you set out, or as you began to move around and look into these second world countries, you realized that's the game they were playing?
I did. I started with two concepts in mind. You know, first of all, I had stacked on my desk three stacks of books. One that said America will continue to dominate the 21st century. One that said Europe is the new global standard setter and diplomatic leader for the future. And the third stack was books about how China and the Pacific are going to, you know, take over the world. And these, to me, were obviously mutually, you know, they're not reconcilable. At least these books were not making efforts to confront each other. And I wanted to bring these three totally different theses kind of, you know, into one and try and reconcile them, make sense of them, because last time I checked, we all exist on the same planet, but these books were pretending like Europe, America, and China don't, you know.
Yeah.
So that was the first sort of motivation. But I was convinced that these are the three poles of power and influence. I call them centers of gravity, really, in the world. And I really believe that is very much the case and will continue to be. The second, though, was to evaluate this geopolitical transition through the eyes of these strategic second world countries, rather than just reading doctrines from Beijing or Brussels or Washington. That's a very easy thing to do. It's much more difficult to see if they work. So the point was to go out and see, you know, which diplomatic strategies are actually having an impact around the world, and who's doing it right. Is China's strategy working, or is Europe's, is ours? And, you know, depending on where you are, the answer is very different. But the answer in no place is the answer American dominance is, going to continue in perpetuity because of business as usual.
Yeah. One thing I note about this book, I'm speaking with Parag Khanna, author of The Second World, is that the book about us and the Second World, as you say, can be written from Washington or London or Brussels or so on.
Right.
But you, the book you set out to write could only be written by you being on the ground in those countries?
Right. I mean, I set out, originally to do a TV show.
That's right.
Second World countries.
That's right.
But no TV station picked me up to do it. Now I'm certainly entertaining offers to go out and go back to some of these countries and bring them to life the way I tried to do in the book. It's a very difficult task. There's a lot to say about each place, and in the book you only get, you know, maybe 7 to 12 pages, pretty dense pages on each of these countries. But absolutely, I think the whole thing would have been a total flop if I hadn't spent the years traveling instead of sitting at my desk. So that was the really key hinge to getting the arguments right, to learning what's really happening in all of these places, and to ultimately, I suppose, to validating the kind of thesis that I set out with.
And I would guess for a listener or a potential reader, they should know that since the book is rooted in your travels, it is not just a book of theories and numbers.
No. I mean, it was de-wonked, by my editors, and I'm grateful to them for doing that. You know, it's not a think tank book. It's published by Random House. And, it doesn't have all the juicy travel bits and details that I would have loved to put in, but that also might have gotten outdated. But I called my methodology aesthetic. You know, I wanted to capture not just ideas. I really wanted to include sensory perception and judgment about what I saw in places. So there's a lot of observation about culture and society. And you know, now, as a result, I get a lot of emails from people around the world who say, wow, you really just hit the nail on the head in capturing, you know, Brazil or Turkey or Kazakhstan. And they say, this is exactly how we are and who we are. And, you know, that's always very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. And so let's go again to some of what you're saying there, which is your perspective, Parag Khanna, was the Second World, but it ends up leading you to this idea of the Second World in a global marketplace negotiating with the three biggest players being the U.S., China, and Europe.
Right.
And so to talk about Europe for just a second, Europe is often portrayed in the U.S., less so now that we're all in the same financial crisis together. But the conventional wisdom for so many of the last few years has been, oh, Europe, old Europe, unsustainable socialist economies, safety nets that are going to drag them all down. I interviewed Jeremy Rifkin a couple of years ago, and I have a feeling his was in one of those stacks of books, the ones
right.
that said Europe are going to, and he had a book, The New American Dream, that Europe has the dream for the 21st century. A couple of countries, right after I interviewed him, voted against the EU Constitution. It looked like, you know, maybe it was unraveling. What does, just to set the context on Europe, what does all of that mean and matter?
We use the wrong metrics in evaluating Europe. Europe is a, you know, post-national or supranational, transnational entity. It is not a country. Whether or not it has a single constitution, a single foreign minister, a single president, an executive model like the United States, is not the measure of whether or not Europe succeeds. The measure of whether or not Europe succeeds can succeed by totally
yeah.
different kind of indicators. It can have 27 foreign policies and still succeed. Spain takes the lead in managing Latin American relations. Germany deals more with Russia, France with North Africa. You have multiple centers of innovation, of thinking. It leads to, you know, a bureaucratic nightmare, without a doubt, but we are a bureaucratic nightmare even as one country. So, you know, I mean, And now, most importantly, we are becoming like Europe. You know, some of the commentaries after the Lehman bailout, or sorry, not the Lehman bailout, but the Fannie Mae bailout said we've become the United States of France. So we are learning to be a regulated, managed, state capitalist, interventionist kind of economic model, the way Europe always has been and the way China is. And this part, one of the big arguments in my book is that because two of the three superpowers operated in that way, we were going to inevitably bend to the way they do things, not the world bending to a laissez-faire American model, so-called Washington consensus, and so forth. And I didn't predict the financial crisis, but I certainly predict that we were outnumbered in our approach to these questions, and we lost, quite frankly.
Lost in which way?
Lost ideologically, without a doubt. And now it's
the laissez-faire free market ideology that was.
We can't.
Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher.
Right, exactly. We can't. And Margaret Thatcher had that famous phrase.
There is no alternative.
But of course, there is. we're learning to now do it the other way. Except, of course, we can't afford it, which is what's really, really fascinating and troubling about the present situation.
Yeah, is that it wasn't just the ideology that that got whacked. It was the economy. It was people's pocketbooks. It was people's homes and families.
Exactly.
In this notion of geopolitical marketplace, tell a little bit more what that ends up meaning. You mean it both sort of literally and figuratively for second world countries. How so?
I do. I mean, the a monopoly is what a unipolar world of American hegemony and dominance is. It's literally a monopoly. A marketplace has multiple suitors. A second world or a third world country enters the marketplace and has options. They don't have to do things the American way. They don't have to buy American. They can buy weapons from China. They can get aid and financing from Europe. They can take no strings attached aid from China. They can take weapons from the United States but not reform themselves politically, so they can reject our conditionality. That's the marketplace. You have choice. You walk into that geopolitical shop and there are multiple suitors. So shopping around diplomatically is what every smart country is doing today. Rather than aligning, I call it multi-aligning. Why be friends with just one, superpower when you can be friendly with all three? So the smart countries like Kazakhstan or Saudi Arabia, Brazil, Libya, these countries are out there playing all sides and gaining benefits from everyone.
And you said that from what you could see, the best players at this, at cutting the deals and so on, are the ones that have oil.
At the moment, yes. Yeah, you certainly see that happening with, Malaysia, Iran is doing this well, Kazakhstan, I mentioned earlier, Libya, Azerbaijan, and a few others. Some of the oil-producing countries are playing this game extremely well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me also, you say that, we've talked about what a second world country is. We've talked about how Europe, China, and the U.S. kind of relate to them. What is a superpower? How did you decide that Europe, China, and the U.S. are superpowers, and yet Russia, for instance, you feel is a second world country?
Right. That's a great question because, a lot of armchair grand strategists, publish op-eds every other day saying, in the future there's going to be seven great powers, three great powers, 12 great powers. Everyone seems to have a different opinion on the subject. As I mentioned, I had those three stacks of books on my desk, so I had some inkling that people were actually saying three, even if they wrote articles saying seven or eight or ten. And then I wanted to make real measurements of these things. And a superpower actually has a definition, which is, that entity or empire or power that has global influence, that can shape events all over the world, that can actually, change the way political calculations are made and economic decisions are made. Russia doesn't do that anymore. It has a nuclear arsenal that can bomb anywhere in the world. It's in fact decided to send some planes and ships to Venezuela in a show of strength and solidarity, but it's not really affecting political calculations in sub-Saharan Africa and in Latin America by and large. Another factor is economically. I mean, Russia represents 1 to 2% of the global economy. Its economy is about the size of France. Contrast that with China, which has 14 and growing percent of the world economy and GDP, the U.S. and Europe, which have over 20% respectively. So, you know, to sustain everyone, many people are familiar with Paul Kennedy's book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, where he says, you know, great power, global dominance and hegemony and superpower status are sustained through your economic strength. Only the U.S., EU, and China have that sustainable economic strength. India doesn't have it yet. Not even close. Russia doesn't have it anymore, not even close. And Japan has economic strength, but doesn't have the demographic resources or even the strategic appetite to pursue it. So when you peel away all of the rhetoric about India having a billion people and therefore being a rival to China, and you come down to, you know, how big are their economies really? How strong are their militaries?
How big is the Indian economy?
Well, it's only, you know, again, it's 1% to 2%.
So about the same as Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that talked about the influence of money, the influence of the size of the economy. How about the U.S. is has by far the world's most powerful military, spends more on military than most of the rest of the world combined. Does that matter?
Of course it does. I mean, you know, military power, you know, obviously plays an enormous role in this, and the U.S. military is the only globally deployed force. The question is, how effective is it, and how much does it factor into calculations in different regions? How effective it is, of course, one can say, I'll point to three things: Iraq, Afghanistan, and deterrence. Now, we have a huge nuclear arsenal, but when other countries, as nuclear proliferation occurs, whether slowly or quickly, we become deterred. So our nuclear arsenal or the threat of it, you know, effectively becomes, you know, nullified to some extent. So you could have 5,000 nuclear weapons or 50,000 nuclear weapons. Is America with 50,000 nuclear weapons more powerful than America with 5,000? No, really, it's not. But it has our strategic, or rather our conventional weaponry, our Navy, which is deployed globally, and our missile fleet forces and our ground forces that are stationed everywhere, obviously do have an impact on things. But the question is, does our political military power translate into political success? And that's where Iraq and Afghanistan come in. Clearly, it's not enough. So yes, our military power is great. It shouldn't really be measured based on a dollar value of how much we spend, because you can get, you know, more bang for your buck through cheaper weapons elsewhere. And also, what does a lot of our military budget go to is actually to, you know, things like you know, salaries and healthcare costs and veterans affairs and all these things that don't actually, and just bureaucracy and waste, and billions of dollars worth, which you're very familiar with.
Yeah.
A lot of that money, I mean, does it really impress people when you say we spend more than the rest of the world combined? It may be, but how much of it actually translates into usable forces that are being used in a way that are actually influential and effective?
Effective, I think, is the key one there, yeah.
That's the key word. And when you phrase things in that way, you get a significantly more modest picture.
You actually, a quote I've got of yours is, America itself runs the risk of descending into the second world if it does not renew itself and redefine its role in the world. And I believe you said that before the current financial crisis. So we've said the U.S. is one of the three superpowers. It's no longer the dominant superpower. What are you saying when you say it could descend into second world status?
Yeah, it's, you know, another quote, sort of a corollary to what you just read out, is I think I said we need a Marshall Plan to stay in place.
Exactly. A domestic Marshall Plan.
Exactly. A domestic Marshall Plan. And that's exactly what, you know, Barack Obama has just announced. It's nothing short of a domestic Marshall Plan. You know, it's a massive investment in job creation, infrastructure renewal. And that word renewal is ideological in terms of renewing our sense of exceptionalism and purpose, but we can leave that aside for now. But it's also physical renewal. Our infrastructure dates back to the 50s, and it always has to be renewed and overhauled in order to be at the top global standard. And when you travel in a lot of countries, like in the Far East in particular, in like Malaysia and even you know, Shanghai, you have better roads, you know, better rail systems and all of these things than America does. Far better. You have more internet, you know, higher broadband penetration and access in 18 or 20 countries than you have in the United States.
Now let's just say that for people who would find that surprising, you have better broadband penetration in 18 or 20 countries than we have in the U.S.
Yep. Remember, we have a problem of scale. This is a gigantic country. You know, there's a reason why, you know, a lot of people don't take Amtrak and they take cars. You know, people haven't felt the need to have that infrastructure. Now we need it because of, you know, for energy efficiency, rising costs of fuel, and these reasons, and also just to create jobs itself and to kind of keep the country and keep the economy linked and make it more efficient in that sense. So we haven't felt the need to have that, but most certainly we do now.
Okay, you just touched on something. Very much of what you're saying about a second world country negotiating in the global marketplace seems to accept and be rooted in a context of this global marketplace of globalization. Now, let me ask this question. If we face the twin limits of peak oil and climate change, does that mean that the current model of global trade in which, for instance, American meals average traveling 1,500 miles to our kitchen tables, is that whole model unsustainable, and will it have to be unwound, or is it being unwound even as we speak?
Not necessarily in terms of the sort of, you know, twin limits. Remember, if we're approaching peak oil, if that's the case, and many people, you know, dispute that heavily, it's a topic really for petroleum geologists to debate. But the issue then is, if that is happening, then climate change or the pursuit of reducing emissions is probably the beneficiary, because it means we'll invest more in alternative energy. There's nothing wrong with everyone driving 1,500 miles to the dinner table if they're driving, you know, hybrid cars or alternative vehicles, fuel cells, whatever the case may be. You know, there's nothing wrong with consuming the kilowatt hours of electricity that we do if it's provided by wind power, solar power.
Well, wait. I mean, do you really mean what you just said? In other words, the idea that each country has a comparative advantage in one crop or another, and that they'll grow it and it'll be shipped all those miles. That's what those 1,500 miles, that's where that average comes from, to us and so on. That really will continue if we're just good at coming up with alternative fuels?
Well, part of what the problem is our habits, right? We
right.
have to assume that our habits change slowly, but that technology can be integrated into our lives a bit more quickly. So you can't get people to stop driving all of a sudden. That requires years of, you know, cultural change and building whole new infrastructures and changing habits. But you can put hybrid cars out there and scare people into buying them through high oil prices, perhaps a little bit faster. So I'm just assuming that behavior is slower to change, whereas technology could, if we invest in it more aggressively, could be deployed more quickly.
Right. So what I wasn't so worried about the driving and so on, which I see, but just about the whole notion of food grown in this country to be eaten 3,000, 5,000 miles away, that as as the shipping prices go up and up with fuel costs, as that sort of model that we've been, in other words, what I'm saying is there was kind of a model that put free trade, globalization, cheap energy, no limits on disposal, kind of it all drove to a point. And I'm wondering whether now that we've gotten the closest we've ever gotten to that point, if in fact we're late, because right now we're looking at factors which mean it won't actually, having gotten there, we can't actually sustain that. And you're saying you don't think that that's going to be a big limiting factor.
No, I mean, you know, that's the question, though. I mean, what is sustainable and what is not? It depends, you know, really heavily on technology.
Sure.
And I think that right now, again, in the short term, we're focused so much not on changing our consuming habits, you know, which are, again, very, very hard to really bend, and focusing a lot more on how to make it cheaper and affordable and sustainable to continue to live the way we do, you know. And that's, I think that's just human nature. You know, I wish people could change more quickly, but, you know, we still find recycling is hard to get on a national level in this country. So it takes a very long time for people to change their habits.
So you're saying that you're basically being a realist.
Yeah.
In this. Okay. And let me ask you another. A book that I found really bracing recently was Andrew Bacevich's The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. I assume you've read it.
I haven't. No,
you haven't. Do you know that you know the arguments?
Mm-hmm.
He basically is saying that, military empire, by whatever name, it is not only unsustainable, but a mistake, and that basically has we pursued it because we haven't taken care of problems at home, whether those problems are infrastructure, governance, healthcare, education, et cetera, and that the, that when we that perhaps this financial shock and then this new election may be a moment when this can all be tested and you know, a new way found. Your thoughts about that?
No, he and I obviously see eye to eye on a great many things, but I wouldn't necessarily make the link between guns or butter the way sort of he does. In other words, you know, or as you paraphrased it, we pursue empire abroad in order to, you know, or and we neglect problems at home. We certainly do that, but it's not that we can't afford both, because both are fundamentally foreign financed at this point. So we could really do both, and that's what Obama is trying to do. It's clear that we're going to continue with military expenditures at certain very high levels, if not as astronomically increasing as they have been, still increasing or remaining very high, and yet still attempting to renew the infrastructure, as we discussed earlier, both of which are very, very expensive. But the point about
the end of exceptionalism,
and this is the really important question, is do we still think of ourselves as exceptional? The problem for me with the rhetoric of exceptionalism is that it implies, obviously, uniqueness. But what happens when another power thinks that it is exceptional, and its people do too? And of course, I'm thinking about China. You can't go to China today and not taste in the air that sense of exceptionalism and nationalism and pride. All of those things, it's really a Chinese equivalent, more or less exact, of what we have. You know, this is the talk of, you know, China is the Middle Kingdom and so forth. China is the, you know, center of the world, really. And it's kind of hard to reconcile the fact that America sees itself that way and China sees itself that way. Either neither is exceptional, or we need to stop using the term, basically. So I find it all very quaint, because it's really only people who haven't been to China or haven't traveled around enough to see how opinions and attitudes about America are changing who still actually take and use that word all that seriously.
Okay, let me now turn to another, we talked about peak oil, climate change, so on. Terrorism, radical Islamic terrorism and other forms of terrorism. Let me just put it this way. On 9/11, I felt that the crucial question was, have we done everything we could to minimize terrorism, to make terrorists pariahs within their own societies? And what would we need to do to actually accomplish that? Does that tack make sense to you? And if so, what should we be doing?
I think it's a fair metric to be using, or a goal to have, that our efforts after 9/11 would be devoted to minimizing the amount of terrorism that exists in the world, and as you say, rightly marginalizing or making terrorists into pariahs in their own societies, so that those societies inherently do the policing, you know, for us or for themselves in their own good, in their own interest, rather than saying, we fear America is going to attack and occupy us, therefore we need to export jihadism, you know, to try and bleed the United States, which is obviously the result that we have created. So obviously, against the metric that you've wisely kind of articulated, we obviously have not done a very good job.
And what should we be doing?
I mean, certainly not more. At this point, obviously, we can't do more of the same, because we can't afford
right.
the resources to. I would hate to imagine that we had an unlimited military arsenal and didn't think twice about whether or not it was working. It's a sad fact that people are maybe only waking up to more progressive strategies because we can't afford or don't have the resources to continue doing the same old thing. But that's a very cynical view. More, you know, positively articulated, obviously we need to work much more, you know, in terms of economic development issues in the Arab world and in Muslim countries. And I think that we may start to do that. But again, it's not just about throwing money at the problem. It is fundamentally about governance. And there's some evidence that when you have negotiations with, you know, fringe groups, marginal groups, militant groups, and if you include them in a certain political process, whether it's a democratic one or you know, quiet negotiations, this has happened in Libya and Saudi Arabia, to a small extent in Pakistan and Egypt and elsewhere, it actually does diminish the incentives for radicalism and violence. So, you know, there's a strong you know, link between democracy and political stability. So we have to you know, we obviously have to encourage that much more genuinely and authentically than we have so far.
You talk about building, I mentioned it in the intro, building a diplomatic industrial complex. And at another point you say this book is a book about diplomacy fundamentally. You have a very broad definition of diplomacy. And maybe now is a moment to say, so if you were an advisor to Obama, I don't know if you still are, but for the listeners, if you were advising a new administration, what would this stronger, broader diplomacy consist of?
Well, by the way, this is much more than about advising administration. This is about advising a society.
Exactly.
We have a lot more foreign policy than just what our government does. I think that Google has a foreign policy. I think that the Gates Foundation has a foreign policy.
Disney has a foreign policy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And let's just take the Gates Foundation, which spends more on public health programs internationally than a number of significant international organizations. In fact, because contributions to the World Health Organization in Geneva are voluntary, in some years the Gates Foundation provides up to 30% of the budget of the World Health Organization. So just so it's clear, an international organization gets a lot of money from an NGO, and it's an American NGO. So, you know, America's aggregate sort of footprint on these issues like health and development is a lot more than what its government does. USAID's spending is dwarfed by the total of American charitable giving and foundation giving internationally, you know, by a lot. So it shows that America has, you know, a big presence in the world that shouldn't be measured just based on what the government's policy is.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now that we can't really afford, you know, to have more of the same, even at current levels in terms of international aid and so forth. We really do need to think about foreign policy and diplomacy much more broadly. You know, just look at our educational sector. What has boomed in the last 5 years is the presence of American universities in the Middle East and elsewhere. Everyone wants to partner with an American university. If you go to Doha or Dubai, places like this, you find American campuses popping up everywhere. Higher education is America's best, most coveted, desirable export. And that is a very good thing. It really strengthens the American brand, the American image internationally. And that's not something that the United States government needs to facilitate. It's something that the universities are doing voluntarily, and some of them are actually profiting very handsomely from it, because Arab, you know, Gulf governments can afford to pay for all of the expenses for setting up these campuses overseas and educate their, you know, it's at this point, you know, mostly their elites, but eventually more, you know, larger segments of their population. So there are great things going on that emerge not from Washington, but from everywhere else, and that to me is part and parcel of what America's world role is, and we need to understand America's global influence is significantly more than just what the administration decides to do. And that's the kind of advice I want to give in an age where the government is either too bureaucratic or too bankrupt to do the kinds of things that need to be done.
Okay, let me now turn to an area of your expertise, an area of news and concern right now. The attacks in Mumbai highlight, but only to me, only again for the umpteenth time, you know, the last time might have been, you know, with Musharraf's ouster, the time before that might have been with Bhutto's assassination, etc., that Pakistan, and the other might be India's nuclear agreement with us, that Pakistan, India, what's going on there? What should we be looking for?
In terms of what's going to happen next with Pakistan, India?
Well, and what we as the U.S. should be looking for or hoping for?
Well, I mean, it's clear what we're hoping for. We're hoping that, you know, Pakistan doesn't divert troops from its western border to its eastern border, as you know, some people have threatened would be the case if India were to launch strikes in Kashmir, or were to, you know, send more troops of its own to the line of control in Kashmir, or you know, certain things like that. So we're hoping that doesn't happen. We don't want Pakistan to, quote unquote, you know, take its eye off the ball. I find that whole discussion to be a bit facile. Pakistan has more than enough troops to cover both its borders. You know, the only question is whether it wants to actually use them to confront the Taliban and Al Qaeda, or if it doesn't.
And if it doesn't, it can use this as an excuse.
Exactly. And then again, the whole the whole rhetoric is really quite meaningless, because it is just making excuses to not do what you know ought to be done. So that's one angle to it, though, is simply hoping that the situation doesn't get inflamed further. There's talk about us having a special envoy to try to, you know, revive some of the mediation efforts of the past that go back well over 10 years in terms of Kashmir. But, you know, it has to be handled very delicately. I have, you know, some views on how I think it could or could not be done. But there's a lot of Indian mistrust, actually, of the U.S. despite the nuclear deal finally going through, because, quite frankly, you know, the Pakistan has been getting special treatment over the last, 8 years. And it's also gotten away with, supporting groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, which, you know, has been responsible now for multiple major significant attacks within India, and India has not responded in kind. So the notion that America can simply come in and mediate even handily is not something that India necessarily buys at the moment. There has been a fairly healthy process underway up until this most recent attack between India and Pakistan themselves, sort of track two diplomacy, opening trade linkages, and so forth. And so long as they keep those open, it means that the clock won't be turned back too far from this episode. But it's really early days right now after this most recent kind of tragedy, and I'm not sure which way it's going to go.
What about Afghanistan? During the campaign, we saw an agreement, it seemed, from both parties, from both candidates, more troops in Afghanistan, maybe something called a surge, et cetera, et cetera. What, you spent time there, you've advised, what's going on, what's the biggest danger, what's the best policy?
Well, the decision that's been announced in the last couple of days to reallocate troops and increase the presence of troops more around Kabul is really quite a shocking evolution. It's not shocking in the sense that we didn't expect it to happen. It's shocking that it's gotten to this point where you have this feeling like Iraq in 2005 or 6, where sort of only Baghdad felt safe. And now that's happening in Afghanistan as well. That's really a great, great disappointment to those of us who have, gone to Afghanistan and seen how, there was early promise and a feeling that the country could absorb the kind of international presence that was intended to stabilize the rest of the country, to kind of keep the country unified, though not necessarily by having a strong central government. So many mistakes have been made, though, that now we are at this point where, there's going to be a surge of troops, quote-unquote, around Kabul. There's also going to be a surge, obviously, in the border areas and in the south of the country. And it remains to be seen how it's going to play out. Obviously, even without more troops, we had a policy of conducting certain airstrikes, which led to a lot of civilian casualties, which has led to greater amount of alienation and radicalization against the U.S. presence. That's very bad. Counteracting that is not going to happen through more troops acting in the same way.
Right.
So what I would like to see is a lot more of these provisional reconstruction teams. There have only been 20 active ones in the country, and they haven't really, been as effective as they could have. They haven't, quote-unquote, gone outside the wire all that much, and they have had a heavier military than civilian composition. What we need to see is a lot more of that in terms of actually working with local actors, with provincial governments, with running development projects and so forth, and providing more funding for that sort of activity in the troubled areas in the south and the east of the country. Instead, these PRTs have not been very, there haven't been many of them, they haven't been effective. It doesn't take many troops to have a PRT, less than 100. So ideally, we would put troops into setting up more of these, and you could have, 50 more, PRTs around the country than we have today. And it's one of the only policies that European governments are actually bought into. And they, there's many European elections every single year where the presence of European troops in Afghanistan is a big, hot-button political issue. But European governments can justify deploying more troops for such humanitarian kinds of operations rather than just being part of a military occupation. So
okay,
it's important to think of the politics of it as well.
Right. Okay. So again, the book is The Second World. The websites are paragkhana.com. That's PARAGKHANNA, paragkhana.com, and newamerica.net. Thank you, Parag Khanna. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terry. Great.
Okay.